Accession number 30279, reel number 3.
This is the second reel of a taped interview with Ross Bradbury in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 27th of the 9th, 2007, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Could we talk today about the... Well, you wanted to add a few bits and pieces that you had forgotten to include earlier on.
Well, as a matter of fact, I jumped a month with my children's birthday, which I'll never be forgiven for.
No, that's all right.
So I'd like to correct that. That Guy presently is 46, Greer is 44, and Zoe is 40, and they all have their birthday next month, which all is right. October. Now, also, I'd like to go back to really way back to my grandmother, Mary, who I said was born in Logansport in Indiana, USA. Her father, Edward Sweeting, and the family moved to Canada, he joining the Canadian Pacific Railway to build.
I'll bring you in.
Is that her mother, Mary, died. And she was without medical assistance because they were snowed in and couldn't remove the body, and she remained in the house for some days or maybe some weeks, and which had a very lasting effect on my grandmother, even through her life.
Sure.
Wouldn't have flowers in the house. Now, where are we now? I also like to still talk about my grandmother, Mary, and her sister Laura, who I did mention that they went to the Murchison Goldfields, where she married Alexander Ross. They had five children, and the thing I'd like to mention, that the five children and their house was, which you wouldn't really call a house, it was had a tin roof, Hessian walls, and a dirt floor. Now, you can imagine bringing up five children in our summer temperatures, which is in the old temperatures, well over 100 degrees.
Sounds like the place I'm renting at the moment.
Yeah. So, and Alexander Ross, with his brother, had a gold mine, which I have mentioned, and a hotel. When my mother was getting along a little bit in years, when I say she was still a child, of course, racing around the hotel wasn't too good, so she was sent off to a boarding school, which is a place called Dongra, just south of Geraldton. And the boarding school was a Catholic boarding school, not that that was my grandmother's religion, but because all denominations went there, because it was the only school really that could, in those days.
School at Dongra.
Yeah.
Hold on.
Yeah, as I was saying, Dongra on the coast just south of Geraldton. The at that time, back with the family, there was a...
Are you right?
Yeah. Yeah, so So back about that time, there was a chap called Claude De Bernalis, who you could call a wheeler dealer. As a matter of fact, I liken him to the present-day Alan Bond. And he did some sort of a deal with whatever, which cost Alexander Ross and his brother the gold mine and the hotel. So and he was then suffering from lung disease, which they called it in those days, miner's disease, caused by the lack of ventilation in gold mines and what have you. The family moved to Perth, and he went to a hospital out of Perth called Waterloo, which was a sanatorium, and died at the age of 54. Left my grandmother with the five children to bring up.
So hence you in Perth. You came to be in Perth. Let's move forward if we can.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you want to wing in there just quickly?
Well, no, they moved to Perth and the family grew up in Perth, the Ross family, and my mother married William Bradbury, and hence...
Here you are.
Here I am.
We had left the last interview with you giving some sort of indication of the impression of the Japanese on their entry into the Second World War from December 41.
Yeah.
Obviously, it was soon after that that they were sinking the Prince of Wales and the Repulse, you know, the pride of the British fleet, all of that, and whizzing down the Malayan Peninsula towards Singapore. How was that sort of sudden success seen?
Well,
here's a country that couldn't build a bike that didn't fall apart as soon as you bought it. How are they suddenly being so successful, do you think? How was that seen?
Well, I think the whole nation got a terrific jolt and a wake up. The fact of what they were, probably what we all were ignorant of, with the highly mechanized, very competent armed forces, both land and sea, and I guess the politicians also suddenly, and I recall our Prime Minister recalling the, much to Winston Churchill's disgust, calling the Australian Armed Forces back from the Middle East and as quick as they could. Just going back on a little bit of history, I think the 8th Division, they were by... sent, but to Singapore.
What was the impression then when Singapore fell? February 15th, 1942, the jewel in the crown almost, you know.
Well, yeah, it was supposed to be absolutely impregnable. And of course, next thing, it was captured. The battleships and what have you were sunk. And the biggest jolt, of course, as far as Australia, the British surrendered, which meant the...
Everyone was in the bag, all of them?
They were, and as we know afterwards, it was just a shocking experience. And the deaths of many, just through brutality.
How did that affect you as a young chap?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, by that time I was in the Armour Division, and we were going away. But we still didn't have any equipment, so to speak. But of course, the Americans, by this time, all their convoys, which were heading to the Philippines and other places, were diverted to Australia. And we, I was, being a Brendan Gun driver, I was in a small little party sent to Melbourne, down to Port Melbourne, to await the arrival of the various transports carrying arms to take delivery of the tanks, which were named the General Grant tank. Now, this was quite an experience. I think there was about 10 of us, maybe, and obviously under an officer of a lieutenant. And we arrived on the wharf, and we were met by the wharfie in charge. And obviously the lieutenant had a little bit of a chat with him that we were here to take delivery. And the wharfie made it very well known to him that you don't cross this line. That's our territory. And we unload the tanks. And when it comes over that line, you can take delivery of it. So we sat in our truck. And the first really example of unbelievable, now the Japs are knocking at our door, more or less, and the hatches came off after some time. The big crane, we were only in one place in Melbourne because there's only one crane could lift these tanks. The hook went down, and then a whistle blew, smoke out. So everyone walked off, didn't see them for about, 15 minutes or so. Then they came back, and slowly this tank came up, because we'd never seen a General Grant before, because it was a bit mind-boggling, huge thing. And it was lowered on the wharf, and then went across this line. We could take delivery of it, which obviously we had tractors and things. We didn't start them up because I had no fuel on them. And that was deposited over there. So this went on for about a week. So it just shows you
people talk of the sort of slow-moving wharves in Australia and wharfies going on strike during war.
I know, they did.
And driving everyone crazy because they're trying to fight a war here.
Yeah.
Particularly with the threat of the Japanese. How did it affect your position, though, within the army? You would obviously become part of Z Force. How did that come about?
Oh, well, just finishing up with my time within the 2nd 10th Armoured Regiment, we were then sent to the Jap threat. Then was seen, of course, on the western side of the Australia, and the whole armoured corps was sent to the west, which was rather nice. I was coming home, and we went north and sat there, and obviously nothing was happening. The threat then of actually an invasion of Australia was slowly dissipating. And at that time, there was volunteers call for a special job. So I put my hand up.
You never volunteer in the army.
No. It's a fatal mistake. Not really, but at any rate, and I was interviewed. My background, of course, being pretty good swimmer and had done a lot of sailing in my youth, and well, right up till I joined up, actually. And so I was selected, still didn't know what I was volunteering for, quite frankly. And so there was about four or five of us, and we were then off to Melbourne to the headquarters of SRD, Special Reconnaissance Department, was just a name that they gave the. They had their headquarters in 225 Domain Road, South Melbourne, or South Yarra, I think. Anyway, a very palatial home. And of course, terribly impressive for someone that had just been rolling around Australia in a tank. And then we were told what the operation was. It was a special raiding part, Horse Head Special. And they had other segments like M Special, Philo, and something else. And then we were off to Fraser Island.
What did it mean to you to know that you were going to be a part of a sort of special force?
Well, it was quite exciting, really, you know. Because you sort of stepped out of the army normal discipline, not disciplines, but routine. Suddenly you had some priorities, and which I'll recall, and I'll tell you later on, but not too certain how we got to whether we flew up there or not, because the SRD had priority number one, which I'll mention now. I think we flew up there and we went out to just slipped the name of the airport in those days. At any rate, there's a DC-3 there, and we racked in. It was about four or five of us, and there was captains and majors and everything all waiting to aboard, and suddenly they found out that they were overloaded. So we walked on, corporals and sergeants and what have you, and the majors and lieutenants were left behind. But you could see the looks on their face, they couldn't work out what priority we had. Anyway, we went to, flew to Brisbane, and we were camped at Milton, on the Milton tennis courts, which was the leading tennis courts in Queensland in those days, which was the AIB headquarters, the Allied Intelligence Bureau. So we camped there while things were made for our onward movement just up to Fraser Island. And in the interim, which is worth calling, we went into Brisbane. Well, I hadn't seen anything of this before, but the place was absolutely chock-a-block with Americans. And there'd been which is in the history book somewhere, there had been a fight between Australians and Brisbane, in Brisbane with the Americans, and they had divided the armed forces of Americans. The black, call them the black, which is not a very nice word, but they were on the south side of the Brisbane River, and the others were on the city side. And there's just a bridge in between called the Victoria Bridge. And we went, of course, all we wanted to go and have a drink. And the hotels were all on sessions, open for an hour and closed for four or something. And they'd all line up. And inside, the barmaids or whoever, the attendants, would fill up the schooners of the year, and they'd all sit on the counter. On the just imagine in Brisbane, by the time they opened the doors, all this beer was red hot. And they'd throw them down their neck as quick as they could. And next thing, of course, violently yell outside. It was absolutely dreadful. So we said, we've seen enough of this. And our loot said, I think what we'll do, we'll go into the officer's mess the next time we come into Brisbane, which was a Lennon's Hotel, the best hotel in Brisbane. So he issued us with pips, so we became officers. Well, we were sitting there. I think we were so sort of taken away being officers in somewhere where we shouldn't be. I don't think we enjoyed the drinks all right, but it was good fun.
You mentioned being involved in this sort of intelligence bureau, and you talk of a Z special unit and things like that. Presumably no one else knew that you were a part of all of this. It was just within those, the ranks that needed to know. The people in the street wouldn't have known that you were in a special unit.
Oh, I wouldn't have a clue, no. No, it was very, very secretive.
And had you any idea, or had you any knowledge of SOE or anything like that in relation to the origins of Z-Force?
No. No, we wouldn't even know what was going on we did know by media that there were people, say in France and other places in Europe, were activity behind the lines, blowing up trains and doing all sorts of things. But we didn't have much background, really.
What were you initially told about Z Force, about Z Special Unit, and what it would be involved with? You mentioned this intelligence and that sort of thing. Were you told much about what it was you were going to be doing, the duties that you would be undertaking?
I think, yes, they made it quite plain or clear that our work would be behind Japanese lines or territories, and there'll be special targets sought, and apart from that, they really didn't give us much actual what we were going to do at this stage, and so we left the ARB headquarters and flew up to Maribor, I think, and then we caught a barge across to across to Fraser Island, where there was a camp. Which was a training ground, and then we really got to know what was going on. Then there was pretty rigorous physical training, unarmed combat, and all these things, and raids. We would there's a lot of lectures, and when I say lectures, of tactics and things outlining what we could envisage us doing.
Can you shed some light on what those lectures were? I mean, what they were telling you that you might be doing?
Well, because I guess the targets weren't sort of uniform, put it that way. They could be by sea, dropped in by submarine, parachute or foal boat canoe. So that was our training. We did a lot of foil boating. It's just a two-man canoe with paddles. And they call foil boats because they could be packed up and like in a valise and carried. And some of the training was to paddle up the Murrumburra River, and we divided up because there was shipyards at Murrumburra, and there was a railway marshalling yards. So our job was to sneak in there and put dummy plastic explosives on a train, on an engine, or put a limpet, which was a little magnetic explosive on a ship, and without being seen by the security. And then on the way up, we'd camp in the mangroves overnight with about 10 million mosquitoes, and then paddle back, which was quite a big operation, actually. You know, it would take 2 days to get there and a couple of days to get home. And
how successful was your first attempt?
Well, we got out with not being detected, which was good fun. And then we had a revamp afterwards, of course, you know, discussed what we did. And we had sort of umpires with us, or whatever, so to pick out if we made faults or what have you. And back in the main camp, there was a lake called Beautiful Lake. This place around has got these lovely freshwater lakes. Called Lake Mackenzie, and we'd have to virtually run with equipment on from the camp to Lake Mackenzie, which was a reasonable distance, and then swim, and then out and equipment on again, and then some exercise. We'd go to the ocean side, and there was a wreck there. I think, if my memory serves me, it was the Mahina, which had blown ashore when she was being towed to Japan. You wouldn't believe this. It was being towed to Japan for pig iron to be broken up so it could be fired at us later on. But it never got there because it ran into a cyclone. It was blown ashore. And we'd go over there and put plastic explosives on it, dummies, of course. And some of them were dinkum. There's no one there. It's only us on the island. Apart from some timber cutters, which were in a certain area. And after that, we had sort of done our training. We were ready to go somewhere.
You mentioned to me earlier on that you thought that it was fun. And here you are, sort of sneaking up to boats in your foil boat, putting dummy mines on the side, all that sort of thing. But, and I do get this impression that it was a fun thing for a young bloke to be involved with.
Well, I think that I guess we weren't looking at the possibilities that, you know, you may be sprung, and things were all very exciting, sort of 007 and what have you. Then we were formed into a party then,